Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I am your host. Hey, I want to thank everybody for tuning in on this weekend show, as well as everybody who has been tuning in throughout the week, as I have been really doing my best to keep everybody as updated as I can in terms of what markets are performing well and where the money is flowing. Also trying to take a step back from all this day-to-day noise and understand what some of the long-term trends are. That's what Jesse Felder and I are going to chat about here in the first two segments. Jesse Felder does write the Felder Report. He's one of my favorite guests to bring on a about monthly basis. And Jesse, let's start with the U.S. equity markets, because there's no doubt that these markets just continue to push to all-time highs. There is a lot of optimism out there, and there is a lot of, I guess, money still in the system that is flowing into some of these lagging sectors. But we look at something like sentiment. The sentiment levels have reached extreme bullishness dating back to really early 2018. And if everyone remembers 2017, that's when the markets just consistently moved higher day after day. Not much volatility, just straight up in a, well, gradual sense. Jesse, what do you take away from how bullish sentiment has gotten right now for U.S. equity markets?
Well, I think, you know, we are seeing today nothing less than, a euphoric speculative mania in the stock market, the likes of which we've only seen in 2000, at the peak of the dot-com mania, and probably 1929 before that. Jeremy Grantham's probably one of the wisest market watchers out there. And, he recently told, I think it was the Financial Times, that, yeah, this is now a full-fledged speculative bubble, very similar to those earlier periods. And all those data points would validate that. One that I look at and I blogged about last week was the RIDEX ratio. So RIDEX traders, is a fund family that's been around for 20 plus years. So we have data on when these traders get, you know, super long leveraged funds or super short or what have you. And you can put together a ratio of how much money they have in, long levered funds versus short versus cash. And their positioning has never been more aggressive than it is today. In fact, the previous peak was, as you mentioned, early 2018, was January 2018. We also saw some similar, a couple of peaks that were close to that over the last couple of years that all lined up with the peaks in the stock market. In early 18, again, kind of in the late summer, early fall of 18, before that fourth quarter sell-off, which was brutal. Again, in December-ish of last year, right before the pandemic crash that we saw in March. And so these traders have actually gotten more bullish than that in terms of their positioning. It also comes back to something we've talked about a fair amount together, Corey, which is the trading in the options market. It was astounding to me that in the week, the Thanksgiving shortened week, we saw 35 million call options traded, based on U.S. equities. And in that shortened week, that was a record for any week in history. And that was a holiday week, basically a 3.5-day trading week. And so the amount of money that's been pouring into call options is totally unprecedented. And that ends up becoming the tail wagging the stock market dog, as we've talked about before, where, that forces option, market makers to hedge by buying underlying common stock. And so all of these signs point to a speculative euphoria like, that we've very, very rarely seen before in the stock market.
So in all fairness, though, this euphoria does sometimes go on for a lot longer than people think, especially when it reaches these extreme levels. But the question really is then, how much more money is on the sidelines to come into these markets? Because as much as there's been a rotation trade, there's also been new money flowing into the markets. Any thoughts on this, Jesse?
Well, it's, you know, people talk about this money on the sidelines, and I really don't think there's you know, anything to this idea of money on the sidelines. It's really, to me, more a matter of positioning of a lot of these leveraged strategies that matters more than anything else. And I'm talking mostly about, you know, the short volatility trade, and, you know, so that would be, you know, short volatility in all its different permutations. And so, to me, I would consider volatility targeting, which a lot of insurance companies use to, you know, underlying type variable annuity type products, and paired also with risk parity, you know, which is, you know, massive hedge funds kind of leveraged to this trade, which they're basically just leveraging up, you know, into the stock market and other asset classes, but mainly stocks, as, you know, as far as we're concerned, based on what volatility is doing. So when volatility is coming down, they're levering up. And that's exactly what we've seen really since March, is volatility coming down and all these strategies leveraging up again. And that's really, to me, the primary dynamic behind all of this volatility that we've seen since that 2018 Volmageddon February crash that we saw when the short volatility trade blew up back then. And then volatility came down, they levered back up, and they levered, you know, to the point where they couldn't lever up anymore. And then we had that fourth quarter 2018 precipitous sell-off, a levering up in 2019 before the crash earlier this year. And so, you know, I don't monitor this stuff closely enough to know just how leveraged these trades are at this point. But I think it's fair to say we can guess that after, you know, leveraging up since March, you know, nine months or so of leveraging up, this trade's got to be pretty well levered. And if you just look at the short volatility trade directly, it's pretty clear that they've put all these trades back on.
So then where does that leave us, Jesse? We're, I guess, due for some sort of a pullback, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a drastic pullback, does it?
Well, so I do think it means, yes, we're going to basically, since that 2018, we've seen increasing volatility. We had that Volmageddon crash in February of 18. Then we had a nice rally to new highs. And then that fourth quarter 18 sell-off was even bigger than the Volmageddon crash in February. Then we had another rally to new highs within this broadening pattern, this megaphone pattern that's formed over the last 3 years or so. And then we had an even bigger crash in March, where we took out all the lows previous. And so I do think this pattern, you know, just basic technical analysis would tell you that we're seeing a pattern of widening highs and lows. And we should expect, you know, that it's increasingly probable that the next sell-off, you know, could be as even more dramatic than what we saw in March. And it's, like I said, it just comes down to the fact that it's these leveraged trades that are driving the market now. It's not traditional money flows.
So, Jesse, what are you going to be watching to indicate that this market is going to start rolling over?
Well, you know, to me, I look back at the 2000, what, you know, the last time we had a speculative mania like this in 2000, it was driven by the Y2K fears. And so there was a massive pull forward of demand, people buying computers and software in anticipation that, you know, the rolling over the calendar to the year 2000 might cause a technological, you know, breakdown. And so all those tech stocks that benefited from that pull forward of demand just went to the moon in 99-2000. But then there was a huge, you know, gaping black hole of demand afterwards, where everybody who, you know, needed to buy a computer over the next 3 to 5 years now didn't need to buy one. And so when you saw that black hole of demand materialize, it precipitated the crash in the NASDAQ and the tech stocks. And I think we've seen something similar with the pandemic, where you just think about all these stay-at-home stocks have seen, you know, a massive pull forward of demand, whether it's Peloton or Zoom or any of these stocks, Netflix, Amazon, that have seen sales accelerate dramatically as a result of the pandemic, there's going to be a very similar black hole of demand for these stocks. And when we start seeing the year-over-year sales growth decelerate, it doesn't need to decline, it just needs to decelerate, it could precipitate a significant sell-off in these companies with the valuations have gone to the moon. And so I'm watching these names, and you can see them they've started to struggle over the last month or so as a part of a broader rotation in the stock market. But when these things really start selling off, they are the majority of the stock market. So there's going to be a reckoning. It could be very similar to what we saw in 2001 and 2.
All right, Jesse, I also want to talk about this stimulus trade or expected stimulus that is coming out of the U.S. or out of the U.S. government. A lot of people are looking forward to that sometime next year, early on next year, when we actually get the government issue settled in the U.S. But the recent proposals of the stimulus packages are far less than what they were just a couple months ago. Break down what you're watching here and what's important about understanding what stimulus could come out of the U.S.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that I think probably the negotiations between Nancy Pelosi and, you know, the Senate Republicans before the election was, you know, really going nowhere. And I think the Democrats were hoping they'd win with the Senate and be able to pass whatever they wanted in terms of, you know, stimulus. Now that they haven't won the Senate, or, you know, there's a runoff in Georgia to determine that, but it looks like, you know, there's a good possibility they won't have the control that they were hoping. You know, they're much more willing to, they have to be willing to compromise and work with, you know, Senate Republicans to try and pass something. So what they're talking about now is, you know, $900 billion or thereabouts, which is still very large, but it's nowhere near as large as Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump wanted to pass, you know, a couple of months ago. And so I think that, you know, there are implications of that. I think who knows what the dollar was pricing in, you know, because with the dollar selling off now, you would think that if they're unable to pass as large a stimulus, that would be bullish for the dollar. But it looks to me as if maybe the dollar was pricing in that they would be able to pass nothing, you know, and now that it looks like they're going to pass something, that's net dollar bearish. And that's why we're seeing the dollar roll over.
So do you think the dollar weakness is going to continue then? Because the dollar arguably is breaking down. It's close to breaking down. Let's put it that way. There is a lot of air underneath this level, right around 90, 91 on the dollar index. What do you think about future prospects for the dollar?
Well, you know, I've been dollar bearish for a few years now. The dollar did rally nicely over the last, I don't know, year and a half or something like that. But I think in the short run, I have to temper my bearishness. And really, since over the last few months, I've been cautious towards gold. And, you know, part of the reason for that is that I've thought that we could see a dollar rally. I do think sentiment right now is probably getting too bearish towards the dollar. I think everybody right now, the consensus trade is, you know, for the dollar to continue lower. But if, you know, the stimulus that ends up getting passed is less than, you know, what was hoped by everybody, I've got to think that's dollar bullish. And, you know, if they don't, there's a good chance they don't pass anything still, I think. That's probably a better probability than what people are pricing in now. I mean, with the vaccine news and everything, there's probably a lot less impetus for any stimulus at all. And so I do think that, you know, there's if you look at the futures market too, there's just a massive amount of money that's betting on a lower dollar right now. And so there's a potential that I see for a risk-off period, a sell-off in the stock market that would be, you know, concomitant with a dollar rally in the short run, a short squeeze on all those dollar shorts. And to me, that's kind of what I'm anticipating right now.
So elaborate a little bit more on the gold trade, because gold has been correcting for about 4, almost 5 months now. Looks like it found at least a short-term bottom late last week. But what do you think about the prospects of gold maybe testing out some of those recent levels around 1760 again?
I think gold could actually, trade down even under 1700, even to, you know, high 1600s, some point over the next few months. I just think the prospect of rising real yields is just not a bullish backdrop for the gold price. And I do think longer term, the dollar is going it's in the middle of a major bear market. And so that's going to be a net major bullish tailwind for the gold price over time, over the next, you know, few years. But over the next 3 to 6 months or so, I do think gold could continue to correct. It's not unusual in a gold bull market to see, a 20% decline in the gold price. I don't use the typical, 20% is a bear market definition that many people use. But I mean, gold could easily have a 20% correction, which would put it in that high 1600s area. That we saw that in the 2001 to 2011 bull market for gold. I think there was a couple of 20% price corrections in there. And so that wouldn't be unusual at all.
Jesse, real quick, I just want you to elaborate a little bit on that comment regarding real interest rates, because those are key drivers for a number of markets, especially the precious metals. But I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And what do you look at to get a true perspective here?
Yeah, you're right. I think a lot of people look at implied, real rates or, what have you. I look at, straight up the 30-year treasury yield less core CPI. And when that, when that rate is negative, gold's usually up year over year. And there's such a close relationship, actually, between that real rate on the 30-year and the year-over-year change in gold, that it works as a really good forecasting tool. And when you have real rates rising, like we do over the last several months, it usually means gold's gains are at least going to be tempered a bit, if not reversed. And that's kind of the situation we've been in for several months now.
So then, Jesse, what sectors are you bullish on right here? Where do you see opportunity for investors?
Well, the last couple of times we've talked, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned that I've been just pounding the table bullish on energy. In fact, my fists are hurting from pounding the table so hard over the past few months. Energy had an incredible month last month in November, but I still think it's very, very cheap. And if we are seeing a major bear market in the dollar, that's so bullish for the oil price. And we're still seeing, it's amazing to me to still see such negative sentiment towards energy when it just had its best month in history. And people are still talking bad about Exxon and Bloomberg is still running peak oil articles. These are very rare opportunity you come across. It's very, like I mentioned, I think last time we talked, oil today reminds me of gold back in 2015, late 2015, when it was just completely left for dead. And you have a Federal Reserve that is dedicated to creating inflation. And at the same time, the most hated asset class on the planet is that one asset class that would provide you the best inflation protection, perhaps, out of any asset class, and that's energy. And so I do think energy's only really begun to shine, and this is going to be a multi-year period. The last time we saw this type of bearishness in oil like we see today was 2001-2, around the same time as a great time to be buyer of gold. The gold bull market was just taken off. Energy too, I think The Economist in 2003 proclaimed the death of oil, and they recently just basically ran the same headline again, which to me is very, very bullish. Last time they did that, oil prices just screamed higher for the next several years.
All right, Jesse, we're going to wrap it up there. It's always great having you on the show, buddy. I appreciate all of your insights and really just a level-headed look around what's going on in the world and not getting too stuck into any certain narrative, because things are changing quite rapidly right now. And over the next month or two, we're going to see how this vaccine rollout happens in select countries. And if it does go smoothly, then, well, I think we need to readjust some of the expectations for next year as well. But hey, again, a lot can happen. Jesse, it's great having you on the show. Thank you for your time this weekend. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, Corey. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. In this segment, we are switching our focus and focusing more on the energy sector, as I am chatting with Joseph Schachter. He writes the Schachter Energy Report, also has a free report for everybody called Eye on Energy, which focuses on some of the fundamentals, the data that comes out around the energy sector. The Schachter Energy Report, that one is focused a bit more on some of the stocks and opportunities that Joseph sees available to investors. Joseph, let's start off with the underlying oil price. Oil has recently popped to around this $45, $46 region. Seems like a lot on the back of optimism that we're going to be getting back out to some sort of a daily life or our daily routine. What do you think about this pop? I assume you are not buying into this move higher, especially after our last few conversations.
Yeah, the basic issue here was there was fear that OPEC was going to raise production in January by 2 million barrels, going from their original, the cutback of 7.9 to 5.9, and UAE was not really keen on doing that, and Saudi Arabia, more importantly, wasn't, but UAE didn't like their quota, and they thought they should get more allocation. So there was a bit of a battle here between those who wanted to keep 6 months more, volumes off the market and tighten it up and get inventories down, and those who said, the quotas allocations were not fair. In the end, the smaller countries that wanted to get more allocation won. The government, the OPEC deal is for 500,000 barrels starting in January. Every month they're going to look at it, and they're going to look at either a plus or, up to 500,000 more. And so there's going to be a monthly meeting to kind of manage this process. What's interesting, though, is when they gave the allocations out, Russia got 125,000 barrels of it, and Saudi Arabia took 125,000, and all the smaller players who are the ones who've been cheating regularly, UAE, Iraq, Iran, Nigeria, Gabon, all of these have been producing over their official quotas. They all got minuscule increases in quotas, which means you're effectively saying that, these guys are going to continue to overproduce as they need revenues to sustain their, their governments and meet their, fiscal needs within each country. The other problematic thing is, of course, Libya, which has gone from under 200,000 barrels a day in September, is now at 1.3 million barrels a day as the civil war is over and the country has brought back production faster than anyone thought they would, because there was some damage to the pipelines and facilities, but they got them back on. And the country is now saying they'll get to 1.6 million by the beginning of 2021. So you've got, OPEC raising production. You've got Iran, cheating and selling more to, especially with a hope that the new government in the United States on January 20th will be more amenable to it. So they're planning to sell more to China and India. And India's the energy minister that said he's looking to buy more from Venezuela and from Iran. And then you've got Venezuela wanting to ship more. So there's going to be a lot more product coming on. And the question is demand. And that really, you know, goes down to two issues. One, Asia's recovery is very strong, and China's now importing more than it was and consuming more than it was pre-pandemic in January, February of this year. The North America and Europe issue, where the pandemic continues to have debilitating impact on the economy. You saw today's job report in the States, which was half of what was expected in terms of new, you know, gain in jobs. So we're looking at weakening issues until the vaccine comes out. And, you know, the vaccine may be March, April, May. Well, between December and March, April is quite a bit of time. So the I think the increased supply, weakness in demand until you get into late Q2, I think is going to make things difficult. And if we do see inventories rise, which I think is likely, in the United States, last week demand came down significantly. You saw crude oil demand fall by almost 700,000, 688,000. Finished gasoline demand fell by 156,000. And even jet fuel, because you had the Thanksgiving long weekend and you had a lot more consumption of jet fuel, it still was 35,000 lower than the prior week. So we're looking at weakening demand as more lockdowns and more, more issues are coming. And of course, when the new president gets inaugurated on the 20th, he's talking about masking and then regional hotspot, shutdowns until the numbers come down. So I think prices of oil will back off from the 46 level where we are today. I think we're going to see sometime in December below 40. And then during Q1, the issue of how bad does the lockdowns occur, how severe, do the number of caseloads go up? And then, does Christmas prior to that Thanksgiving right now, the number of deaths in the U.S. is now at record levels. Does that accelerate and get even worse once Christmas is over because of people visiting and the same thing in Europe and Canada, et cetera? So I think we're going to be looking at first quarter where sub 40 is likely. And the question is, how low below 40 do we go during Q1 how weak do the economies get because of more coronavirus task force requirements of shutdowns?
Okay, so overall then, the supply and demand you still see as being bearish for the underlying oil price. But one other thing market-wise that we can look to is the continued breakdown in the U.S. dollar and how a breakdown in the dollar does support higher, broadly, commodities prices. How much of a role do you think that dollar breakdown is playing currently in that move up to about $45, $46 a barrel? And if the dollar remains weak, could it help support generally higher prices than the supply and demand factors are telling you?
Yeah, I think that's a good point about the dollar. We've gone from 94, 95 on the dollar exchange to 90, 91. There's some forecast that it could go below 90. Weakening U.S. dollar means commodity prices usually elevate, and we've seen that in the metals, base metals, grains, and other things. But I think at some point the rising yields, especially on the 10-year and longer yields, where we've almost had a doubling in the 10-year yield, now we're pushing almost 1%. The spread between the U.S. and Europe and Japan and other countries is widening materially. And the U.S., of course, is needing so much new debt to be sold. If the Fed is not monetizing it, then that means the market has to come up with the money, which means higher yields to attract investors. And I think at some point that will stabilize the U.S. dollar, especially because that spread is getting so wide. If the U.S., if the dollar starts to strengthen 92, 93, 94 back where it was just a few months ago, that would be part of the push to lower the commodity price for crude oil and other commodities during Q1 of 2021.
Okay. Now, in terms of, I guess, moves in terms of the stocks, we are entering the end of the year, and we do hear about tax loss selling, and quite frankly, well, oil stocks, energy stocks broadly have been under quite a bit of pressure, except some of those clean energy aspects or sectors. But what do you think about tax loss selling further, driving down some of these stocks?
Well, we've had, people need to remember that we started the year at 146 on the S&P-TSX Energy Index. We're 92 today, so we're still down 37-38% year-to-date. So sometime during the next 2 to 3 weeks, we're having a good day today on the upside, but we're on, being Friday. But the key is we're going to be seeing tax loss selling activity start in the next week or two, and it usually lasts till just before Christmas. So my expectation is that next week will be a critical week to start seeing some of this tax loss selling. And then people will be looking at, if they own a stock that was at 8 at the beginning of the year, and, it might have been 2 at the low, but it's at 4. If they've taken capital gains elsewhere, then they're going to still want to trigger those losses so they pay less in taxes to the federal government. So my expectation is that we will see quite a bit of tax activity. And also in the states, they're talking about raising the capital gains tax rate. So I think you're going to see sometime in the next week where people are going to be in both sides of the border taking both profits and losses to take advantage of the current tax regime, which probably will change once the Biden regime gets elected in the United States.
So do you see a certain group of stocks or sector of stocks within the energy and oil sectors being one that maybe is already very depressed, and any further sell-offs do entice investors, or at least entice you to move in to get some maybe stocks on sale, let's say?
Yeah, my favorite area is the natural gas sector. I think, we're seeing LNG take off from the United States. We're seeing natural gas consumption in Canada picking up. We're getting closer 2023-2024 to LNG Canada coming on. Within Alberta, TransAlta is closing their coal-fired facilities over the next 2 years and going to natural gas-fired. Suncor is building a cogen facility so that they can meet some of their goals for climate, for the ESG issues. So my guess is that that's going to be the favorable commodity. So any weakness that we see in the natural gas sector, that's my favorite. I like light oil and condensate because we're still importing quite a bit of condensate in the country. The area that I'm concerned about is if we see sub 40 again, those companies in the oil sector, in the oil sands and heavy oil, that have high debt loads and have high break-even costs and have bank relationships where the debt maturities are near term, those are the companies that I think will be the most vulnerable on this upcoming correction. And what people can do, I would recommend they do, is upgrade in quality, like maybe take your loss now. And if you want to be in any of the sectors, take advantage of the weakness that's coming and upgrade your quality to companies with cleaner balance sheets, generating free funds flow, stronger managements. There's a lot of companies out there where I'm seeing managements not owning much stock. I prefer to own companies where the managements have significant investment. Their money is there before yours. So there's a lot of things people can look at to do to high grade their portfolios in the coming weeks.
Okay. Hey, Joseph, I appreciate the insights. Thank you for taking part in this weekend show. And the energy sector has been obviously interesting, but I think we're still waiting for some sort of better news to drive oil substantially higher, because you look at where it was really for the last decade, and it was generally at higher prices than this, other than that big washout we had earlier this year. Thank you for your time, Joseph. I'll chat with you again in another month or so. All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm wrapping up this hour with a company update from TriStar Gold, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol TSG, and on the OTCQX under the symbol TSGZF. I'm chatting with the president and CEO, Nick Appleyard. Now, Nick, let's follow up on some drill results. The first drill result, 6 holes in total, from this 12,500 meter drill campaign at this Castelo de Sonhos gold project in Brazil. Now, one of the 6 holes did have to be abandoned, so we had 5 drill results outlined in the table of the news release. Nick, instead of going through number by number, we did see kind of generally similar results, I guess. Some widths between 1 to 13 meters and grades between 0.4 grams per ton up to 1.6 grams per ton. Nick, give us a little background on these drill results initially, please.
Yeah, hi, Corey. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, so this is the start of our drill program. Now, as we said in the release, we've got a minimum of 12,500 meters, but you know, I think it will be well over 20, potentially even 30,000 meters by the time we finish. So it's the start of a major long drilling campaign. Yeah, and these drill holes, as you suggest, the first one had a bit too much water flow and slightly undersized drilling rig on it, so we had to abandon under 50 meters. So can't read anything into that one, as it didn't hit the target depth where we were aiming to intercept the conglomerate. Following that, we moved the drilling rig to Esperanza East, where there's lower water flows and, you know, a bit easier for that drill rig to drill while we waited for a bigger compressor. And it hit, you know, five holes in this sort of priority two zone. We were very encouraged because all five did hit reefs, did hit mineralization, and that's now going to allow us to vector in on the most optimistic reefs and the best possible horizons there. And then that's sort of the point of this drilling, is let's get the information and then use that as a vector, because now we have this great understanding of the stratigraphy and you know, where the highest probability targets are.
So, Nick, can you give us a little bit more information on that comment you just made there? Is that this Esperanza East is priority number two in terms of targets?
It was priority two on this drilling, really, because there's known mineralization there, and we wanted to get into new areas and hit new things where it's not known. So, you know, we know we've got some gold at Esperanza East. We've done some drilling there in the past. We have a small inferred resource there. So we always wanted to step out so we can try and improve that resource, increase it, and grow it. These holes were sort of part of that program. They've done that. The grades at Esperanza East, I don't remember offhand, but I'm presuming it's around 0.8. So they're pretty close to in line with what you'd expect from there. They have extended the resource there, I presume, when we recalculate it. So it's an area we're always going to hit. It's an area that's always going to be part of the project. Any ounces we can develop in this area are going to be high value, because they're going to be close to the operations that we're currently defining at Esperanza South. But they weren't really a high priority in this program, because we really want to hit the exciting new targets, which will show a lot, you know, show the growth a lot more and open up complete new areas for us to grow into.
Okay, so one final thing to note about these drill results is, if anybody's looking at the news release in figure one, you can see that these drill holes came on the northern end of this Esperanza East project, or deposit, I guess we can say. Let's talk big picture for this drill campaign, though. You have two RC drill rigs. You outline three general goals in this news release. One, complete drilling required for the pre-feasibility study. Two, test for additional near-surface conglomerate-hosted gold. And three, test for new targets of remobilized gold near granite contacts. Take us through the goals and what investors can expect in terms of future drilling.
Okay, well, the first goal, complete the drilling for the pre-feasibility study. That's the one, I guess, with the tightest time restrictions on it. Most of that is done. We've completed over 20,000 meters of infill drilling already. We've just got a few little things to do. Probably most critically are the geotechnical holes in the pit walls. They are being done, I believe, starting in about 2 or 3 days' time, and should be completed before Christmas. Beyond that, there'll just be a few little shallow holes testing shallow resource continuity, which will hopefully be done before Christmas as well. So really the plan is that pre-feasibility study drilling, there may be one or two holes leak into January, but we really hope to have all that done before Christmas. Then the tier two targets, the additional near surface conglomerate, that's when we sort of call it more of the same, you know, 120 meters down is about the maximum we go, looking for conglomerate hosted gold near surface, you know, that would be potential material for use in an open pit project. There's a lot of strike. We have a lot of area where we're identifying this conglomerate. And a lot of the work we've been doing now is helping us really identify which horizons within the conglomerate are the best hosts. And you know, that's where a lot of the work we've been doing recently has been focused. And then the obviously third target would be completely new ore bodies or new gold mineralization previously unidentified at site. But we've seen hints of it. We know we have remobilized gold. We know that concentrates, and occasionally when we find it, it can be on quite a bit higher grade. So we're focusing on areas where we've had conglomerate with gold in it being intruded by granite. So we're drilling close to those contacts, looking at understanding the mechanism of what's happening to that gold in that conglomerate as it's intruded by a granite, as hot fluids are basically coming through it and remobilizing minerals. So we've now completed, I believe, three of those holes, and those results will be available early January at the latest. So we'll be interested to see what comes out of that. And again, you know, the first few holes may be vectoring us in on the on where we want to get to, you know, do the real test.
Okay, so those are some of the more exploration holes too, right? Trying to get an understanding of where some of the more resources could be, or even higher grade resources. There are a number of mentions of this AI being used, artificial intelligence, and I know that you guys are working with Goldspot, but can you give us an update on these AI targets? Are they defined now? Are they close to being generated? How are you using some of this AI, artificial intelligence information that you're receiving?
Yeah, the artificial intelligence and work with Goldspot, it's been fascinating. I mean, it's as a geologist with a science background, I mean, it's fascinating stuff to work with. But we are now seeing a very tangible, practical result out of it. In that press release, we issued a map, which is a new surface lithology map based on the AI interpolation of geophysics and geochemistry, and, you know, all at the same time is what that we can't do as a human being. But what it results in is a map with probably 10 times the detail than our old geological map that's done by the geologists mapping in the field. And that then helps us. And then with the AI, it's also not just a surface map, it's a 3D map. We've got the down dip underground, you know, 3D shapes as well. So this all goes into our targeting. And also now, you know, when we drill a new hole, and these holes in Esperanza East are probably going to be a perfect example, we're doing geochemistry on them, we do multi-element analysis on those samples. And we will use that to vector and find out exactly which of these units we're in, which horizon we're in, if we're close to a favorable horizon, if we're above it or below it, and that tells us where to go for our next drill hole. You know, we didn't have that level of geochem and that analysis in the previous hole, so you'd just drill a hole and you'd have to try and guess where you are, if you've got to go deeper, if you've got to go shallower, step back up, strike. So it is really giving us some very tangible results right now, and it's fascinating to see, and it's been quite a journey.
So would you say this information helps you build some of these near-term ounces, or I guess low-hanging fruit ounces that the company might have missed without this information?
Well, the ounces we have already defined, obviously, were pre this. You know, I think everything we're going to do now, yes, this new work that we're doing, it's contributing. It's one of the tools, and it's a major tool now that our geologists are using as we move forward. And it's going to be iteratively improved as we keep moving forward. We actually have a world-class paleoplacer expert on site now. He'd prefer to be on site in Brazil rather than in lockdown in London. And he's there sort of doing that iterative ground checking and, you know, sort of feeding information back. And then they give us an updated map. But it's those maps that are going into these targets now, yes.
So then, Nick, in terms of future news flow, obviously a lot of drilling on tap and a lot of core already in the labs. But please just give us a general update what investors can expect moving forward here.
Yeah, we should be releasing, or we should be receiving results every few weeks now. You know, I think we send from site about every 2 weeks, and it takes about 5 week turnaround. I think we get a very good response from ALS, and we're super happy with them. Yeah, so we will be releasing them. I think it's going to be not so much the actual drill results themselves. I think the important side of the story will be us sort of saying, okay, here's a new area. Like one area we want to hit is called the Valley. You know, we hit the Valley area, and it's going to be, okay, here's five holes, the Valley, they've all hit this. But then we start to think, okay, well, the Valley strike length is 1.5 kilometers long, so trying to understand what the full potential is. And I think that'll be the storytelling that we'll be doing is, we've hit this, we've got five holes in this area, but the potential of this area is X, you know. So it won't just be the drill results, it'll be what they mean. Because, you know, if you hit an area which hasn't got a drill hole in and there's 2 kilometers of strike there, you know, you've got a lot more drilling to prove the whole thing up, but the potential becomes obvious quite quickly. So I think that'll be the picture that we'll be drawing with our press releases in January, February, March, April, as these results come out, the new area, and try and explain the potential of that area, the potential of the new shallow conglomerate targets in the different areas as we hit them. But those news will be coming out on a regular basis now.
All right, one quick follow-up just on that, and then we will wrap it up. How many new areas, like the Valley area, are you guys targeting?
It's hard to put a number on them. Right now, we've probably got drill holes planned for 4 areas in the next 3 or 4 weeks. But I think it's just as we go, that's going to open up. There's another 3 or 4 areas I know that we want to hit. We haven't planned the drill holes for them. So as a round number, I would say about 10. You know, but it's going to be an iterative process. I mean, if we hit one, it gets really exciting. We might want to keep the rigs on there a little bit longer. It's, you know, you're going to be driven by results to a certain extent. But right now, we've got about 4 areas that we want to hit in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, and another 5 or 6 after that.
Okay. Nick, we will wrap it up here. I appreciate you joining us and wrapping up this first hour of the show. If anybody has any follow-up questions for Nick or any of the guests that I've had on the weekend show or any of the companies or guests that I've had on throughout the week, please just email me, fleck@kereport.com. I love hearing from all of you, our listeners. And hey, everybody, thank you again for tuning in on this weekend show. Please keep all the emails coming. I hope you all have a great weekend, and I will be back at it on Monday. Nick, thank you for your time. Everybody, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much for having me, Corey.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.